It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, an antique of any size seems to hold a piece of its previous owner, making it unique. We hear from a photographer who spends lots of time outside looking for the perfect shot, but also finding some surprise artifacts of the past along the way. First, we're taking a look at some of the week's top news in national politics. The race for the next Speaker of the House is in high gear, with Nancy Pelosi looking likely to regain her old position. President Trump reportedly planned to ask the Justice Department to investigate Hillary Clinton and James Comey last year, and a congressional ethics panel reprimanded the head of the House Freedom Caucus for his handling of sexual harassment claims. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts and questions. What would you like to see from the next Speaker of the House? Are you curious how the election process works for that post? And after President Trump's public calls for an investigation into Hillary Clinton's email use and reports that Ivanka Trump used a personal email account in the White House, is email an issue that concerns you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Scott Wong is a senior reporter at The Hill, where he focuses on House leadership. Scott, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, let's start out with the story that you've been covering, Scott, the race for House Speaker. Nancy Pelosi seems to be solidifying her support. Here's a listen to Mark Pocan of Wisconsin talking about her chances.
If there is anyone who can count votes, it is Nancy Pelosi. So I would rule nothing out. I would say the odds are that Nancy Pelosi is the next speaker at this point.
One big development came when Martha Fudge of Ohio, a rumored challenger, decided to endorse Pelosi. Why is Fudge deciding not to run for the position herself?
Well, I think it was increasingly looking like an uphill battle for Marsha Fudge. She is a former chairwoman of the Congressional Black Caucus. A lot of Black Caucus members were actually endorsing Nancy Pelosi and lining up behind Pelosi. And it looked more and more like the rebels who wanted to see change at top of the leadership were running into some pretty stiff headwinds. And so Pelosi and Fudge met in Pelosi's office late last week on Friday. And they talked about their priorities and things that Fudge wanted to see. And within the last 24 hours, there was a deal between Fudge and Pelosi. Nancy Pelosi said that Marsha Fudge will be the next chairwoman of a new commission on elections and voting rights. This is a topic that's very near and dear to Marsha Fudge's heart. And in return, Fudge said she would back Nancy Pelosi. And so that's sort of how the deals are done in Washington.
Well, and similarly, the freshman lawmaker, kind of an up-and-coming star already in the Democratic Party, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, she's one of the most progressive Democrats, and she has signaled she's likely to support Pelosi. What was it that Pelosi offered her in terms of priorities that won her support?
Well, we don't know exactly what has been offered so far, but in recent, actually within the last hour, Ocasio-Cortez tweeted that she likely will be supporting Nancy Pelosi for Speaker because she is the most progressive candidate out of all the names that have been floated so far. And Ocasio-Cortez, as we know, is sort of this progressive firebrand, somebody who's upsetting the apple cart in Washington. And but like Pelosi, sees Pelosi as a progressive leader and the strongest name out there of all the names we've heard so far. And so it is possible that Pelosi will create this new climate change committee that Ocasio-Cortez was actually protesting just outside of Nancy Pelosi's office last week. And I expect we will see Ocasio-Cortez have a seat at the table on that new climate change committee.
So there doesn't seem to be a clear opponent to Pelosi, but there is a group of House Democrats who are pledging not to support her. Is that group big enough to make a difference right now?
Right now, they're certainly big enough to make a difference. It's unclear if they are big enough to derail her bid for Speaker when they go to the House floor on January 3rd. So there's actually going to be two votes, as many of your listeners will know. There's two votes. One that will happen next week, that is an internal closed-door vote of the Democratic caucus. She just needs to win a simple majority of Democrats in that vote. And then, once she sort of wins the Democratic nomination for Speaker, it goes to the House floor, where she'll have to win more than half of all of the House of Representative members, so which is about 218 votes. In that vote, a handful of Democratic insurgents could try to derail her. They would probably need between 18 and 20 votes to derail her. This group that signed an anti-Pelosi letter just yesterday had 16 names on it, but one of those names was Brian Higgins from New York, and he actually reversed course today and endorsed Nancy Pelosi, saying that they had cut another deal and that she agreed to prioritize infrastructure next year and to expand Medicare. Those are two of his big priorities. So already Pelosi is picking off these detractors one by one.
And before we move on, Scott, what would you say is the common thread among those Democrats who are saying they will not support Pelosi? Where would you put them on the political spectrum?
Right. So because Pelosi is a liberal, she's obviously from San Francisco and has been a progressive champion for decades, the challenge is mostly coming from the center, people like Tim Ryan of Ohio, who challenged Pelosi 2 years ago, and Seth Moulton of Massachusetts. They are more of the centrist members. Among the new freshman class, a lot of them are centrist members. But I would also say that there are some liberals who have been clamoring for change just because they feel like the current leadership has been in office for too long, you know, and sitting in the current leaders, including Pelosi, have been leading the party for more than a decade.
We're talking with Scott Wong right now. He's a senior reporter at The Hill, and we're taking a look at some of the big news stories out of Washington so far this week. And let's move on, Scott. On Monday, the White House announced it would fully restore the press pass of CNN's Jim Acosta, but also established new rules for press briefings. What are they telling reporters are those new rules?
Well, I think the most important rule is that reporters would be restricted at press conferences to ask only a single question, that there would be no follow-up questions unless the president directly said it was okay to ask a follow-up. Now, that's not been received very well from the White House Press Association. Their president said that they expect all White House reporters will continue this decades-long tradition of asking follow-up questions and won't necessarily abide by those rules. But the White House is saying that if you don't abide by those rules, your White House press pass can be suspended and you will not be allowed on the White House grounds.
And I believe that part of that no asking follow-up questions is also once you ask your question, you literally hand the microphone back to a staffer. So even if you ask a follow-up, you're not going to be amplified.
Yeah, that's true. It's, you know, obviously this all stems back to the exchange with Jim Acosta of CNN and the president, where Acosta refused to give up the microphone once a White House staffer had tried to get it from him. And it resulted in quite a scene and a spectacle and a very animated back and forth between Acosta and the president. Some people said that was simply Acosta as a reporter doing his job and following up and asking tough questions of the president, but I think others took it as perhaps showboating and a real disrespect for the office of the presidency. You know, one thing in the U.S. Capitol that I love about my job is that reporters in the Capitol are able to roam freely in the Capitol and catch lawmakers, you know, in the hallways, and we have much fewer restrictions than the reporters in the White House do, and so that obviously has been a much tougher job for them.
The rules that govern press briefings in the White House, are those up to each administration to decide? How often are restrictions like this floated, and if they have been in the past, have they been successful?
I don't know the specific history because I have not worked in the White House before, but I think there's give and take between different administrations and the White House Correspondents Association. There has been obviously a long-standing relationship between the press corps and the White House. There are times when they clash over certain tough stories or may disagree about how an issue was covered. But by and large, I think most past administrations understand the need for a free press and understand the role that the press plays, and certainly have used the press to help get their message out, when it comes to certain key issues and addresses to the country. But I think with the Trump administration, this is really the first time we've seen, a president attack the free press, as the president likes to say, the fake news, in such an aggressive manner. And certainly, as I mentioned before, there's been clashes between the press and the White House in the past, but this has been, I think, the most dramatic and most aggressive attacks we've seen against the United States free press.
We're talking with Scott Wong, senior reporter from The Hill, about the week in national politics. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. After a Congressional Ethics Committee reprimanded two members for sexual harassment issues, is that a topic that concerns you or sways your vote? And with Ivanka Trump being criticized for her use of a personal email account after the issue was used against Hillary Clinton, how much do you care about email security in the government? Let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll pick up the conversation after a short break. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation with Scott Wong from The Hill, and we're digging into the week's news out of Washington, D.C. And Scott, let's move on to a report that came out yesterday that said that last year President Trump wanted to order the Justice Department to investigate a couple of people he saw as political opponents. Talk us through what we know.
Well, that's right. This is the Hillary Clinton.
Yep,
story.
Clinton, okay. And Comey.
Yeah, it's interesting. The New York Times reported that the president has spoken to some of his aides about and the Justice Department officials about potentially investigating Hillary Clinton, his former opponent in the 2016 election, and James Comey, the former FBI director who he fired in 2017. And so it's striking because it's yet another example of the president retaliating or trying to retaliate against his political opponents. In this case, it's obviously very serious because he's using or potentially trying to use the government, the Department of Justice, to investigate some of his biggest critics and political opponents.
And what did he want them to specifically be investigated for?
I'm not exactly clear on that, but clearly these are people who have been vocal about the president in the past and have used Twitter and other media interviews to attack him. And I think, as the president has shown time and time again, there's only one thing he really cares about in terms of politics, and that is political loyalty. Any sort of opposing voices, the president is very quick to push back on.
Well, and even though the election itself was 2 years ago now, it's still a regular feature in his rallies, talking about Hillary Clinton, calling her Crooked Hillary, and people chanting, lock her up.
Yeah, it's striking. I mean, we reporters in Washington frequently joke that the 2016 election is never going to end, because when you go to these rallies or when you watch these rallies on TV, it really feels like, we're back on the 2016 presidential trail. you know, at those Trump rallies where lock her up was a common refrain. Obviously, in light of this new Ivanka Trump story, you know, that phrase is suddenly has some new meaning. So there's a little bit of irony here.
So the fact that it's come out that Ivanka Trump had sent numerous emails from a personal email account that dealt with White House business, and the one of the main issues that has been brought up time and time again by the president about Hillary Clinton was her use of a private email server. They are drawing distinctions between that, saying that Ivanka Trump had no classified information that was being sent out, but it's hard not to see at least some pretty strong parallels between the two.
Yeah, I mean, there have been Republicans on television all week saying it does look very hypocritical for Ivanka Trump to be using personal email to be discussing government matters. And the reason we care about Ivanka Trump is she's not only the daughter of the president, she has an official role in the White House. She is an advisor to the president, as is his son-in-law, Jared Kushner. And both of them, we know from the reporting, have used private emails and email servers to conduct government business. Now, we don't know the extent of that. It doesn't seem like from the outset that these are super sensitive matters, but until we get a chance, or until you know many of the congressional committees get a chance to review each and every email, we won't know whether there was any sort of classified or secret information being discussed over these private email servers. And it is now interesting that while Republicans have control of the House until January, the Republican chairman of the Oversight Committee in the House, Trey Gowdy, has opened up a preliminary investigation into these Ivanka Trump emails. And I know that in the Senate, the Republican chairman of Homeland Security over there, Ron Johnson, has also opened up, or at least is asking questions and seeking information about these emails. So it's a pretty prickly situation for Ivanka Trump.
Ron Johnson, of course, Wisconsin senator there.
Your senator, correct, yeah.
Scott, before we move on, do we know how this idea that the president floated about wanting the Department of Justice to investigate Clinton and Comey, how was that received in his inner circle?
I don't think, you know, I think it would make his White House attorney shudder because, again, you know, the president is not supposed to use his office, the presidency, to punish his political foes. And so it really could open the president up to, you know, in the most serious case, to criminal charges of abuse of power. And it's something I'm sure that the special prosecutor who is investigating Russia and President Trump in the White House is watching very closely, if not already asking questions and interviewing people about. It's certainly, I would say it's certainly surprising, and it could put the president in some real jeopardy.
We're talking with Scott Wong from The Hill, taking a look at some of the biggest news stories out of Washington this week. And Scott, let's move on to the House Ethics Committee. They have formally reprimanded two representatives, the most prominent being Republican Mark Meadows of North Carolina. He's chair of the Conservative Freedom Caucus. What did the committee reprimand him for?
Well, that's right. The House Ethics Committee said that Mark Meadows handled a sexual harassment case against his chief of staff very poorly. Essentially, when women in Mark Meadows' office reported that his chief of staff was sexually harassing them, making inappropriate comments, touching them inappropriately, and making them feel very uncomfortable, that instead of removing him or firing him on the spot, he simply ordered the chief of staff not to talk to any female employees and kept him on the payroll for at least 2 months. And so the ethics committee did not take kindly to that and has ordered Mr. Meadows to pay back taxpayers $40,000 that would have been the salary for the chief of staff during that period where he was allowed to stay on and collect a paycheck.
The ethics panel also singled out a Democratic representative from Nevada. What are the details of that case?
Yeah, this is Representative Kuhn, from a Democrat from Nevada, who these sexual harassment cases took place when he was in the Nevada state legislature. So they were before his time in Congress, although they are very serious, and therefore the ethics panel decided to investigate them. He was found to have made unwanted advances towards women who were required to work with him as part of their job. So these would have been staffers in his office, female lobbyists who were being paid to, have meals with the Congress, with the then state representative Kuhn. And so the ethics panel reprimanded Congressman Kuhn. And this case actually resulted in him deciding not to run for reelection this past November. And so he will not be returning to Congress. And but obviously this will be a stain on his reputation and make it very difficult, I think, for him to find future work.
Well, Scott, as always, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Scott Wong is a senior staff writer at The Hill. He was with us for our weekly look at the top news in national politics. Coming up after the news, after a hike in the woods, you might expect to come back feeling refreshed and full of fresh air. Our next guest spends a lot of time outdoors, and sometimes she comes back with some treasures from the past. Anything from a 1920s makeup compact to antique bottles. We'll learn more in just a bit. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're with listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, a bipartisan group of U.S. senators is working on a massive overhaul to federal sentencing laws. We'll talk to a criminal justice expert about the bill's potential impact. First, if you're always on the lookout, nature can offer a bit of a treasure hunt. An Eau Claire-based photographer always has her eyes wide open during her frequent walks by the riverside. She's found an old brooch, small antique bottles, the ornate handle of a drawer, all unnatural objects that have ties to people of the past. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Maybe on a nature walk, exploring a part of a river, or even doing some garden work, have you found an unnatural object in a natural space? Call us and share your tiny treasure of the past at 800-642-1234. Tina Ecker is an Eau Claire-based photographer whose photos have appeared on Volume 1 on WEAU News and in the Chippewa Valley Museum. Her photographs are featured in the article Down by the Riverside, Slowly Discovering What the Water Once Took Away on volume1.org. Tina joins us from our Eau Claire studio. Tina, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what gets you outside to walk? What's the main reason you're out there?
I'm always out taking pictures in Eau Claire, and that's really what started it. I went to my favorite spot in Eau Claire along the Chippewa River and happened to start seeing things just literally laying above ground, whether it was a Victorian button or even railroad spikes. There's just a ton of things laying along the river.
And do you remember what the first thing was you found?
The first thing I found was actually found along a lake, Half Moon Lake. It was at Carson Park, and my husband and I were out for a walk. Of course, I had my camera. I looked down, and there was this metal oval piece of something. I pulled it up, and here it was. It looked like a vintage drawer pull. It was just beautiful. And it was so much fun going back home and doing some research and finding out how old maybe it was. And so that's what really started it. And that happened a few years ago. But last year is when I really started finding these treasures from the early 1900s, late 1800s along the Chippewa River.
So what does it feel like? I mean, you're out there doing your work as a photographer, but then you find these unexpected items. What does it feel like when you spot something and you're like, oh, there's another one?
Well, my husband can tell you I get really, really excited. So, and usually when I go out, I'm always coming back with something.
And so what are some of the other items that you found?
I think one of my most favorite treasures would be a horseshoe, which was most likely from the logging era. And it was interesting because a few minutes before I actually found the horseshoe, I found a $20 bill crumpled up laying in the mud. And then I found this horseshoe shortly after. So I'm like, good luck.
Wow. Yeah. If you had found it the other direction, you would have been a true believer.
Exactly. I probably would have. Yeah. It wouldn't have been good.
Well, we have Brenda in Monroe on the line at 800-642-1234. Brenda, what have you found?
Well, one day I was weeding my garden and I was pulling up Queen Anne's lace trying to get rid of it. And all of a sudden something caught my eye. And I looked down and realized that it was a ring from my childhood that my kids had lost about 5 or 10 years earlier.
Oh, my gosh.
So yes. I'm guessing that they lost it in the garden and then it just got covered over with things?
I'm guessing. Apparently, that's what happened.
Wow. Had they actually confessed to having lost it earlier, or was this the proof you'd been waiting for?
Nobody confessed having lost it, but we knew it was gone because nobody knew where it was.
Wow. Well, congratulations on finding it, Brenda. And that's quite a find, something
oh my
that
gosh.
You thought was gone forever. And there it is. So how hard do you search? Or, Tina, are you really turning things over now that you know stuff's out there? Are you digging around, or are you kind of keeping it at the, if I see it, it's meant to be?
That's exactly what it is. And the areas that I'm finding things are usually areas that get flooded. So I'm thinking that, you know, the dirt is literally washing over them. And a few months ago, I found this beautiful, beautiful Victorian brooch just laying there in the weeds. I couldn't even believe it. And how could it be there for probably 100 years and nobody has seen it?
That's amazing. It makes you wonder if it somehow made its way up to the top because of some disturbance.
Exactly. And it makes me wonder what else is out there. And that's what keeps me going back.
Well, Tina Ecker is an Eau Claire-based photographer whose photos have appeared on Volume 1 and on WEAU News and in the Chippewa Valley Museum. Her photographs are featured in the article Down by the Riverside, Slowly Discovering What the Water Once Took Away on volume1.org. You can share things that you have found when you're out in nature by calling 800-642-1234. Now, Tina, as we've said, you're a photographer, and mm-hmm. so have you. You've started taking pictures of these found objects.
Yes, because I do it. Sometimes I feel sad when I find them that they've been laying there for so long. So I love to bring them into the spotlight and make a picture with them and have something to have forever.
And it's clear in your excitement and kind of your sense of wonder about mm-hmm. these items that they feel special to you. Do you feel a connection with whoever might have lost them or left them?
I do. It's a personal connection and also a connection with the city of Eau Claire, with the history. I almost feel like I'm transported back in time when I find them.
And we have not quite ready on the phones yet, but tell us more. You said that you've really kind of gotten more serious about this in the last few years. Do you have a number or a guess of how many items you found?
I have boxes of treasures at home that my husband can attest to. I have a lot of things. You know, some things are broken. It's always exciting when I find a whole bottle, but even pieces of bottles with like embossed writing that it says anything like a date from the late 1800s or even, you know, the words Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I get really excited when I find there. Anything that I can use to, when I go home, you know, do research to find out more about it.
Yeah, so where are you doing research? Is it the same kind of maybe sites that someone who is looking for, you know, to figure out the value of something, an appraisal kind of site?
Yep, just just online. Really, any information I can find is good information.
Wow, it's really interesting. Let's go back to the phones at 800-642-1234. And Cynthia in Door County is with us. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What have you found?
I found a ID bracelet with a woman's name on it. It was actually two hearts linked together, you know, in the center of the bracelet with a woman's name. And I'm actually driving to Thanksgiving celebration now, so I can't remember the woman's name. But it was a small herb garden at the back of my house, which I've dug in many, many times and had never found it before. So it's kind of strange. Mm. I asked all my older neighbors in the neighborhood if they knew of anybody by that name that had lived there in my home previously, and nobody recognized the name, so it's kind of a spooky little thing. And actually took it to a jeweler and had it cleaned up. It's kind of made of aluminum and something else. I can't remember what she said, but just, you know, what a treasure. It's on my bookshelf, and I wonder about this woman all the time. So,
was the jeweler able to give you any sense of how old it might be, Cynthia?
She did, but I can't recall right now. I think maybe from the 40s or something like that.
Wow, well, thanks for sharing that story with us. And Tina, you also take photographs of historical buildings near Eau Claire. Does that feel almost like you're recording history on the largest scale and on the very smallest scale?
Oh, yes, definitely. Yep. And actually, when I started my interest in photography, my husband and I went to the Lake Eau Claire County Park, and I found a beautiful stairway, and it was very old looking, so I took pictures of it, and through social media found out that they were actually the original stairs that led to the Eau Claire County Courthouse.
Oh, wow.
So, I think I just love anything historic, so I'm always trying to take those pictures.
Well, let's get to one more caller. Emmy in Presque Isle is up. Hi, Emmy.
Hi. I have you on speaker. Is that okay?
You sound fine. Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I found a whole treasure trove of bottles, antique bottles, in one spot. And I don't think they use plastic labels, so they're like works of art. Like your guest said, they embossed things, and they put beautiful designs on them. And then, of course, some of the lettering is embossed or whatever, however you say it, on glass.
Wow, and different color bottles, I'm guessing?
No, most of mine are clear.
Oh, okay.
I'm looking at them now. But, like, just beautiful designs on them. I mean, and then one little one I found, I don't know what they used to eat, but like malted milk little tablets.
Oh, yes. I remember seeing something in an exhibit at the Wisconsin Historical Museum about that, but I can't remember the name of it, but I do know what you're talking about. Wow, well, thanks so much for that, Emmy. And let's sneak in one more call, Mark in Three Lakes. Hi, Mark.
Hi.
So what'd you find?
Well, I found a gold money clip with a diamond on it with $640 in it.
Wow.
I was working as a maintenance man at a local establishment. I was doing my normal routine, and I didn't turn it into the office. I says, if somebody comes in and says, hey, I lost something, send them to me.
Okay.
And nobody came.
All right. Well, thanks for that, Mark. So not quite outdoors, but that's quite a find. Tina, as we wrap up, do you have any advice for people listening who might be thinking about a post-Thanksgiving dinner hike and how to keep their eyes open for these little treasures out there?
Honestly, just take time out for yourself, you know, just really open up your eyes, really look. You can look for things, enjoy the nature, you know, maybe get off your phone for an hour or two during the day and really enjoy what's out there, because there's a lot that people are just not even seeing.
Well, Tina, thanks so much for joining us. It's a really fun project.
Thank you again for having me.
Tina Ecker is an Eau Claire-based photographer whose photos have appeared on Volume 1 on WEAU News and in the Chippewa Valley Museum. Her photos are featured in the article Down by the Riverside, Slowly Discovering What the Water Once Took Away on volume1.org. Coming up, we'll talk about the First Step Act. It's a bipartisan bill that's being called the biggest rewrite of federal prison and sentencing policy in a generation. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, President Trump is being criticized for his continued support of Saudi Arabia, despite the CIA's finding that high-ranking Saudi officials and the country's crown prince were involved in the murder of a Washington Post journalist. We talked to an expert about this latest development in American-Saudi relations. First, a bipartisan group of senators is working on a bill that's being called the biggest rewrite of the country's criminal justice laws in a generation. It's called the First Step Act, and at a news conference last week, President Trump announced he'd be supporting the bill.
Today, I'm thrilled to announce my support for this bipartisan bill that will make our community safer and give former inmates a second chance at life after they have served their time.
But the bill's future is still unclear, with Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying the Senate might not have time to take it up this session. Ken Stride is a clinical professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He's worked on juvenile and adult corrections policy since the 1980s. Ken, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
As someone who's had a career in criminal justice research and policy, what's your reaction to this legislation that, like we mentioned, could mean the biggest reforms to sentencing laws in decades?
I think the biggest is a big word here. This is reminds me more of a Bill Murray movie where it says baby steps. I can understand why it's being marketed that way, because for bipartisanship, you want to say this was a heavy lift and we really had to work hard. When you look at the reforms that it has, they're good reforms, but the immediate impact on sentencing and things like that will probably not be as significant. What they've done is, I think, something that possibly Wisconsin, as they're approaching what to do with prison populations, is to realize that it's a complex thing. You know, I think the bill really has like 8 to 10 different kinds of parts. They talk about risk assessment so that we're not thinking that this is just people putting their feet up on their desk and releasing prisoners willy-nilly. They're trying to get confidence in there. They're getting things like looking at risk reduction, both in the prisons, giving incentives to prisoners to behave better in prison. Mm-hmm. They have a logjam of people in high security prisons, and they want to build the incentives for them to get to medium security prisons. They're doing things that they're actually taking lessons from a lot of states on how do you properly reintegrate people back into the prison system. For the most part, federal prisoners serve lots longer sentences than state prisoners. Part of it is because the prosecutors in the federal government tend to get the heavy loads. You know, they're the ones who have major, major drug importers or people involved in highly complex embezzlement or property crimes and things like that. So when you see that the federal system has like about 45% are in there for drug offenses, those aren't just 2-year sentences. Those are 20-year sentences and things like that.
Well, let's dig into some of the specifics. So the bill is seen as addressing some of the tough-on-crime policies that were very politically popular in the 1980s and 1990s. What are some of those key policies, and how is this bill trying to rectify them?
Okay, one of the policies is that several years ago, they, in fact, did do a correction. Some of the listeners might remember that the difference between crack cocaine and powder cocaine was 100-to-1 different. So that means that a person who used powder cocaine could have 100 times more than a person with crack and get the same sentence. They didn't totally eliminate it. It's not 1-to-1, but several years ago they reduced it to 18-to-1. But that was only prospectively for people who were newly convicted after the effective date
that
offense. So one of the things that they did here was they said, all those people who had been sentence prior to that time, and there were some very heavy mandatory minimums that were going on there, and if once those ratios. So the heavy lift on changing that was when they moved from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1. Now they're saying that for about 3,500 of the federal prisoners who were sentenced before that, they can apply to the judge. And they can ask the judge to be resentenced. They're not automatically resentenced, but they can ask for them to be resentenced. Mm-hmm. So to give you a sense of how big that is, it affects about 3,500 current inmates. Altogether, there's 180,000 inmates in the federal system. So not insignificant, but, you know, it's not like suddenly the prisons are empty.
Not a sweeping, we're talking with Ken Streit right now, clinical professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin Law School, and we're talking about a bipartisan effort to restructure federal sentencing law. And Ken, let's look at one of the individual components of the legislation. It's a piece called the stacking regulation, and that makes a crime committed with a firearm a federal crime. What does this legislation do, and why is there a desire to change things?
It's not that automatically if you commit it. It was a thing where if you committed certain types of crimes that were already federal jurisdiction, and you involved a firearm in that, that would drastically increase the sentence you would get. And unlike in Wisconsin, sentencing guidelines are really only guidelines. So, for example, if a judge in Wisconsin goes above or below that guideline, there's no appeal in that. Whereas in the federal system for years, it was very appealable. It was very rigid. And oftentimes, a lot had to do with just simply what did the prosecutor put in the criminal complaint at that time, and that would force the judge's hands. So by taking away the stacking, those usually would greatly enhance what other, not that it was a low crime, but what otherwise was an ordinary crime now was a, you got a much longer sentence. So they took that out.
So as we said, this is a bipartisan effort. That is a rare animal these days in Washington. What do you think it is about this issue and this topic that has been able to bring legislators together who have agreed on almost nothing else?
Okay, sometimes criminal justice stuff has to do with people who get along and are from two different parties and are working on different things. Here, it appears that Jared Kushner had a passion for this, and there are several legislators from each party who this bill wasn't going anywhere a year ago, and he just seemed to have made the effort. Now, I'm not saying that's the only way that did it, but possibly that's what got two very significant legislators in the Senate and the House to start taking this seriously. They were House Chair and also in the Senate. It's still certainly not a done deal, as we see with Mitch McConnell saying, I'm not sure if I have time for this.
Well, and briefly, there was a time where being perceived as soft on crime was a political death sentence. So has that changed that people are willing to stand up for this?
One of the things over the 30 years that you have to do is you generally have to have in marketing your reform, you have to brand it as something that conservative people think is a good, logical idea. So, for example, a big part of the marketing, when you go online and say, where did this come from? They use the state of Louisiana as having used a bunch of the different strategies that they're going to use in First Step. Well, the state of Louisiana wasn't the first or the only state that used it, but it certainly has credentials because it is a state that really incarcerates a lot of people. And so if you can say, well, Louisiana likes risk reduction. Louisiana thinks that reintegrating people using a lot of resources while in prison and after in prison is important. If Louisiana likes it, let's go for it. And so it instantly has sort of a, this is an okay to go forward, not just to people, but to a whole bunch of legislators who are otherwise thinking, who's done this before?
Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us and explaining the details.
You're welcome.
That was Ken Streit, clinical professor emeritus at the University of Wisconsin Law School. He was with us to talk about the potential impact of a bipartisan effort to change federal sentencing laws being discussed now in the U.S. Senate. Well, it's the end of an era, kind of. The kilogram, as it's been measured before, no longer exists. Since 1889, the definitive measure of what a kilogram weighs has been a cylinder of platinum-iridium metal and has been stored in a vault in Paris. Le Grand K, or the Big K as it's known, was like a monarch, with dignitaries from other countries coming to pay homage, well, really to weigh their own standard kilos against it. But late last week, yet another French Revolution was undertaken. Representatives from several countries went to the Palace of Versailles and voted to overthrow the king, I mean the K, as in kilogram. Like most revolutions, this took time to succeed. In fact, it's been talked about for almost as long as the standard has been around. And it wasn't just the kilogram that fell from power. The ampere for measuring electrical current, the Kelvin for temperature, and the mole, which measures the amount of a chemical substance, were also dethroned. All of those will be measured by what are referred to as, quote, abstract constants of nature. All I can say is, the kings are dead. Long live the kings. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.